Welcome to the Day One podcast. For more information about this weekly program featuring outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, visit our website at dayone.org.
Sometimes we do our best work under life's most austere and trying circumstances. We do our best work when life is hard and the load is heavy. Our best work when life finds us in a situation where we would prefer not to be and hope not long to stay.
That's the Reverend Dr. Cleophas LaRue. I'm Peter Wallace. Join us for an interesting conversation and a message of faith today on Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now, here's your host, Peter Wallace, to introduce this week's preacher.
Thank you, Sherry. We're honored to welcome to Day One today the Reverend Dr. Cleophas J. LaRue, the Francis Landy Patton Associate Professor of Homiletics at Princeton Theological Seminary in Princeton, New Jersey. In his role on the faculty there, he specializes in the theory and method of African-American preaching and worship. An ordained minister in the National Baptist Convention of America, Dr. LaRue is the former pastor of two churches in Texas and was also an interim pastor of churches in Harlem and Jamaica, Queens, New York. Cleo, welcome. We're glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
You earned your Master of Divinity and PhD degrees from Princeton, but what led you to join the seminary faculty after serving as a pastor?
I was a pastor early on in my ministry. Started preaching at 19, started pastoring at 20, and went to seminary at the age of 32.
Oh.
And when I graduated, I thought that I would want a different career path than what I'd had. And therefore, when invited to join the faculty, I decided that that was the thing I wanted to do.
And Princeton is officially associated with the Presbyterian Church USA, but you're a minister in the National Baptist Convention. Have you had to make any adjustments there, or have they?
Well, I think we both have made adjustments, and it's been wonderful because they are related to the Presbyterian Church, the people at Princeton. But Princeton reaches out to so many different denominations in the United States and throughout the world, and they wanted that global reach and diversity.
In your teaching, you focus on the theory and method of African-American preaching and worship. How would you describe the major distinctions?
Well, there are several. One, when with respect to African-American preaching, in most instances, we are moving from actual practice to theory because blacks usually have lots of preaching experience by the time they get to the seminary.
Mm-hmm.
We've noticed it throughout. We'll have the students raise their hands. How many of you have experience? Almost all black hands will go up, and the whites, not many.
Mm-hmm.
So with African-American preaching, one big distinction is that in the teaching of preaching, we are moving from actual practice to theory, trying to help them to reflect on what they have already been doing and why they are doing it and what the theological underpinnings are.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the distinct style of African-American preaching has come under the media spotlight this year during the political campaign, where certain controversial snippets of a few sermons were pulled out to raise suspicions or even fears in some viewers' minds. For people who may not be familiar with this approach to preaching, what do you hope they would understand about the context of preaching?
Well, in cultures where there is a heavy oral residue, like the African American culture, there is this wonderful thing called orality, where you actually get up and you orate. And if you just look inside for a few seconds, it seems like, wow, something is wrong with all of those people. They're just jumping up and down, and they're happy, and they clap. Well, they are orating, and then it moves to celebration. Black worship has always been quite celebratory in its tone, but there is content. Black people have a good time at church. And just to take a little few seconds out of that, it looks like, boy, something really is going on there.
Well, your sermon for today is based on an interesting account of the Apostle Paul's missionary activities found in Acts chapter 17. Would you read it for us?
While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was deeply distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he argued in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and also in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Also some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers debated with him. Some said, "What does this babbler want to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign divinities." This was because he was telling the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So they took him and brought him to the Areopagus and asked him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? It sounds rather strange to us, so we would like to know what it means." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners living there would spend their time in nothing but telling or hearing something new. Then Paul stood in front of the Areopagus and said, "Athenians, I see how extremely religious you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at the objects of your worship, I found among them an altar with the inscription, 'To an unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you."
These chapters in Acts are full of action as Paul and his entourage go from place to place with a burning passion to preach the risen Christ. But they've been in prison, they've been beaten and attacked, so they're clearly a dedicated lot. But remind us, first of all, who was Paul and how he got to this place?
Paul, as I say in the sermon, was God's international gospel globetrotter. He was not a regional preacher on the order of Peter and the others, and they were wonderful, but it was Paul, when it was time for the gospel to be revealed and exposed to the civilized world, it was Paul who took the gospel throughout the civilized world, and he had many ups and downs, and it was harsh and difficult, but he was called of God, and he was about the master's business.
And do you think his conversion, which was so dramatic, had an impact in how passionately he pursued his calling?
Well, even before conversion and after conversion, he was a passionate person. This is why I love Paul. He is so filled with life, and whatever is dealt him, he deals with it.
Mm-hmm.
Always. He deals with it. He finds a way to deal with it, and he is ever proclaiming Jesus Christ, no matter what the situation. I love to see this guy as he goes through the difficulties of life, and yet he maintains this deep, abiding faith in Jesus Christ.
Well, Cleo, we look forward to seeing Paul in action in a very difficult place to preach. Your sermon today is entitled, "Why Bother?" Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Splattered across the front doors of a trendy restaurant in Palo Alto, California, were these words: "This is a bad place for a diet." That most visible, in-your-face warning suggested to me that there are certain places where some requests are out of order, and certain times where some appeals are in poor taste. No matter how noble, how worthy, how life-giving they are in and of themselves, there are certain times and certain places where it is simply unseemly to speak of some things. In like manner, it appears to me that we could splatter across the pages of our text this day a similar warning: "This is a bad place for the gospel." Whether one regards Acts as a bona fide historiography or simply a piece of well-crafted Hellenistic literature, the gospel in Athens
comes off sounding like a bunch of misguided, out-of-place hooey. Athens had seen and heard it all. In Paul's day, this once great and proud city was still considered the cultural and intellectual capital of the Roman Empire. It was a city steeped in art, literature, and learning. Of long standing, it had its names and its heroes, and thus was not easily impressed by the new or the now. It was the place where Socrates, Aristotle, and Plato had lived and taught. And still counted among its sacred places was the Academy of Plato, the Lyceum of Aristotle, the porch of Zeno the Stoic, and the garden of Epicurus. The voices of her poets had been heard throughout the civilized world, and the hands of her artists had filled her streets and temples with images of the gods. It was said of Athens that while strolling her streets, you were more likely to meet a god than you were a man or a woman. Her myriad buildings and works of art stood in silent testimony to her former glory and grandeur. Even though Luke goes to great lengths to create for us this scene where Paul is standing face to face with the philosophers in their own town and on their own turf, the upstart Christian gospel still comes off as out of place. It just doesn't seem to fit in Athens. The gospel seems to be out of its league in Athens. Athens is a bad place for the gospel. The gospel seems all the more misplaced when one considers how Paul got to Athens in the first place. Athens is a temporary stopover. He did not arrive there by way of some well-thought-out missionary plan, but he arrived there through happenstance and rerouting, born of necessity, because the work God had called him to do had not gone well in other places. It had not gone as he had prayed or planned. He arrived in Athens not on a set schedule, but on a wing and a prayer, trying to rearrange what unforeseen circumstance had wrought. He does not enter the city fresh and friendly, but he enters disheveled, unkempt, bedraggled, woebegone, battle-scarred, and road-weary. And because he is already in a bad mood, he is immediately repulsed by what he sees. He does not see a city filled with beautiful works of art, but rather a city full of idols. Yes, he probably could have been in a better mood, and yes, he probably would have been better received had he feigned some initial aesthetical appreciation for the works of art he found in the home of Hellenism's literati and intelligentsia. But when you've been stoned in Lystra, jailed in Philippi, threatened in Thessalonica, and hounded out of Berea, it is understandable that you might not be in a sightseeing mood when your friends finally drop you on the outskirts of Athens. May I say here parenthetically, brothers and sisters in the faith, that sometimes we do our best work under life's most austere and trying circumstances. We do our best work when life is hard and the load is heavy. Our best work when life finds us in a situation where we would prefer not to be and hope not long to stay. Like Paul, when life finds you there, do not bemoan your plight, but lift up your head and your heart and go forward with the work God has assigned you to do. So Paul ends up in Athens, not through some grand plan, but through happenstance. Even in the face of the uncertainty, tension, and anxiety that crowd his existence, he continues to press his case for the gospel of Jesus Christ. But his arguing and preaching are not well received in Athens. When the people of Athens first heard Paul speak, they asked with some derision and not a little contempt, "What does this babbler want to say. What does this seed picker, this one who picks up just enough of an argument to speak about it in a superficial manner, what does he have to say? In Athens, God's international gospel globetrotter, our first theologian, and the greatest preacher this side of Jesus Christ, comes off sounding like an outgunned pipsqueak, taking on a fight he must surely know he cannot win. Even when invited to address the Areopagus court, his speech sermon does not go well. After that powerful sermon about the unknown God, there were no mass conversions and no triumphalist claims of victory. The word Luke chose to describe the impact of Paul's preaching in Athens was not all or many, but some. Luke said, some scoffed. Others said, we will hear you again. But some believed. He's in haughty, tawdy Athens. He did not intend to be there. He is not in a good mood. He is not well received. His preaching is so-so. The question just jumps out at you. Why bother? Why put yourself through this, Paul? These people are not interested in hearing the gospel. This is a bad place for the gospel. You are just spinning your wheels, trying to get them to see life from God's point of view. Why don't you leave these highfalutin, know-it-all Athenians alone and go on to Corinth, where you might be appreciated? But do not give up so quickly, for there is some good news in the Athens experience. Running like a thread throughout the Luke-Acts schema is the notion of a universal offer of salvation. It was begun by the Messiah, who preached good news to the poor and outcast of his day, and picked up by his prophetic successors. Thus, in Acts, the gospel is proclaimed to poor widows and proconsuls, to jailers and sailors, merchants and military officers, kings and philosophers. Even in unreceptive Athens, the message is clear. The gospel is to be preached to all. Paul has to preach in undesirable places, under less than ideal circumstances, and so do we, because of God's universal offer of salvation. The gospel is to be proclaimed to all, even if only received by some. I sometimes worry that those who consider themselves most faithful in our day seem the least sure about the universal appeal of the gospel. I worry that those who consider themselves to be the lone inheritors of the Christian witness seem the most determined to turn this gospel to some truncated, privatized religious hope, palatable only to the few and the feeble-minded. The gospel is to be proclaimed to all. We can all say that when ministry finds us in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, where thousands of souls are added to the church. But the true challenge is to say it when ministry finds us on the hard streets of a disinterested Athens. Somebody's got to go to Athens, where they look at you strange and dismiss you out of hand, where they laugh at you to your face and lie on you quick, fast, and in a hurry. Somebody has to speak the good news in a bad place. This gospel is to be proclaimed to all. It has universal appeal and power. It's not up to us to enforce it or to effect it. We are to tell it. The power is not in us, but in God. Some of us act as if we do not trust the gospel to work its way through tough situations. But be it Athens or Jerusalem, the gospel is to be proclaimed to all. That is what we ought to do. Tell the good news of what God has done for us in Jesus Christ, the good news of the coming reign of God, the good news of the power of the gospel to change and transform lives even in this 21st century. It is to be proclaimed to all, even if only received by some. Granted, it's going to be more difficult to get a hearing in this day, because we all live in a time of what Microsoft researcher Linda Stone calls CPA, continuous partial attention. Owing to modern technology, we can answer email, talk to the children, and hold a conversation on our cell phones at the same time with no one thing fully claiming our attention. It will be more difficult to get a hearing now because very little fully claims our attention. It will be more difficult now because a recent publication on the proliferation of fast food in America confirmed what many of us suspected all along, that the McDonald's golden arches have now replaced the Christian cross as the more widely recognizable symbol in the world. Just As I Am has been replaced by You Deserve a Break Today. It will be more difficult now because of the many implications of the postmodern era, with its dismissal of meta-narratives and its debunking of truth with a capital T. But tell it we must, for there is power in the telling of that old, old story. Too oft times we want to be deep and profound in our telling, but I encourage seminarians just to get the basic story straight. For there is power, wonder-working power, in the telling of that old story of the crucified one. Tell them of Jesus Christ. Tell them that he was born in Bethlehem, brought up in Nazareth, baptized in the Jordan, tempted in the wilderness, preached in Galilee, was arrested in Gethsemane, tried in Caesar's court, died on Calvary's cross, and rose from Joseph's tomb. Tell it. Tell it when you are up, and tell it when you are down. Tell it when all is well, and tell it when all is hell. Tell it when you are well received, and tell it when you are absolutely not believed. Tell it until sinners are justified. Tell it until hell is terrified. Tell it until Jesus is magnified. And tell it until God is satisfied. Amen.
Now let's rejoin our host, Peter Wallace, and Cleo LaRue for some final thoughts on this week's message.
Cleo, you described the Athens of Paul's day as a center for culture, literature, and learning. Athens had seen it all and heard it all and loved to hear new ideas just for the intellectual stimulation. And you said it just doesn't seem that the gospel fits in a place like that well. It's too simple. They just make fun of it. They don't think they need it. But it seems to me that our world today sounds a lot like this description of Athens. So what does that say about preaching and sharing the good news today?
I think it says that there is always a place to speak the good news of what God has done for us and for our salvation. And in this day and age, it is the case among many that they feel that we have outgrown Christianity, the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that it is just something that you put in a corner or something that feeble-minded folks think about. But what I'm trying to show is that even in that day, in a city of high learning and literature and art, there were those who thought the same thing. But you have this wonderful, dedicated person called Paul who continues to proclaim the gospel, even in a tough place like Athens.
And you said that the Athenians did mock Paul, and his sermon to them didn't go all that well. There were no mass conversions. He had a very modest impact. But should we learn some mistakes to avoid here, or should we take some encouragement from this for our own witness? We don't have to have these huge successes. We just need to be faithful.
That is certainly what I am trying to suggest. I mean, and we hear so much today, and I'm not putting these down about mega churches and thousands crowding in. I want people to be faithful wherever they are. On some Sundays, it might be two or three, maybe not any, but be faithful to preaching the gospel. That is our work.
You pointed out that Athens was a tough sell audience. Paul was not in a good mood. He was there by accident, and he doesn't get much accomplished, so why bother? But you said that the gospel is to be proclaimed to all, even if it's only received by some. And I wonder if we could get a little practical here. What would you suggest our listeners do with this truth in very practical terms in their lives?
Well, in terms of it being proclaimed to all, even if only received by some, I guess what I'm after there is that it's not always going to be a very positive experience. And there may well be occasions when we don't even know the good that we have done or the people we have helped. Throughout all our ministries, people will come to us from time to time and say, some years ago, you said this, and maybe, especially with me and my preaching, I thought, wow, I really bombed today. Yeah. But you were actually helpful. Mm-hmm. So what comes from being faithful is not always readily apparent to us. But in being faithful, the word of God goes forth.
And it's not our part to worry about the result.
That's right. In preaching, we must preach the good news of what God has done for us in Jesus Christ and leave the results to God. We cannot look back.
Mm. Cleo, what's the one thing from your sermon today that you hope our listeners will keep in mind this week?
That in this day and age, our task is to be faithful in telling the gospel and leave the results to God.
Cleo LaRue, thank you for being with us. We look forward to having you back in 2 weeks.
Thank you. I look forward to coming.
Day One brings you preachers from the Presbyterian Church USA, the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, the Episcopal Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the United Church of Christ, and the United Methodist Church. Donald Jones is our production supervisor and audio engineer, and Peter Wallace, our executive producer. It's been our joy to bring you today's program. Thanks for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller wishing you all God's blessings on day one and forever. This is Sherry Miller. Recently, a listener in Kentucky wrote, "Many thanks for the lineup of excellent guest preachers who are coming to Day One. You folks at Day One continue to amaze and inspire me with your outstanding ministry. Every week, hundreds of thousands of people like you appreciate the insight and inspiration Day One offers. And this fall, we're honored that Day One is once again available through the American Forces Radio Network to our servicemen and women in 177 countries around the world. We'd love to hear your thoughts about Day One. And please, consider making a contribution to support this ministry. Even a small gift of $10 or $25 can make a difference. You can reach us by mail at Day One, 644 West Peachtree Street, Suite 300, Atlanta, Georgia, 30308. Or call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1. Or give securely online at dayone.org. With your support, we can continue to broadcast the positive and meaningful message of the mainline Protestant churches. Thank you.